for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Growing up a child of war in Austria, Chef Nora Poyon's appreciation for fresh, healthful food was instilled early. It led her to ultimately found America's first certified organic restaurant in Washington, D.C., and bring early attention to the now widely embraced farm-to-table movement. But she says we have a long way to go before organic food is as accessible and as much of a priority in our lives as it should be. Nora Poyon's new memoir is titled My Organic Life. She joins me here in the studio. I hope you'll be part of the program. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And I must say, early on, my husband and I enjoyed so many meals at Nora's restaurant, celebrating practically every one of our wedding anniversary evenings there with you, Nora. It's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you. I love your show. I listen to it whenever I can. And it's fun now to sit here, actually, and be on the other side.
I'm so glad you're here. Now, I think many people would like to hear about your childhood. You grew up on a farm in the Austrian Alps. Talk about how that affected your whole outlook on food.
Well, I think you don't realize it, but the first years of your life have an enormous impact on you. And because it was the war and my father could afford it, he leased a working farm in the Alps, in Tyrol. And it was a working farm, and there I saw how hard you had to work all day from sun up to sundown just to procure enough food for the family to live, you know, to have enough food and to put food by for the harsh winters. And it gave me a big appreciation of food. I really have an enormous respect for food. It showed me also how important it is, the quality of the food, and that you not squander food and you don't waste food, and that quality is so much more important than quantity.
Who was the cook in that family?
Well, it was the farm woman. She cooked, and it was an experience for me, too. My mother always felt, don't go there, you interrupt them, because they were so hard working, you know, they stopped for half an hour, and she made this delicious, like polenta, you know, it was sort of a corn mash, and she put the big iron pan in the middle of the table, and everybody pulled out a spoon and just started eating towards the middle where a puddle of butter was swimming. And I just thought it was the best thing ever. And my mother, of course, first of all, she didn't think it was a very complete meal. She always felt that you had to have lots of green vegetables. But I really enjoyed it because I showed how they all sat together, even, you know, working all day long, and they shared a meal together.
And when you first came to this country, what did you find?
Well, I was shocked. I was really appalled at how supermarkets, how everybody went into supermarkets. First of all, I was not exposed to that. You know, you think this was the 60s, the late 60s, and to have, instead of having little stores, you know, the butcher and the baker and the greengrocer, and, you know, you had one big thing and everything was packaged, and the largest compartments and the largest aisles were all frozen food and prepackaged food, and the produce department looked the same all year around. You know, there were no seasons and hardly any fresh, different lettuces. I mean, iceberg and romaine was the gourmet lettuce.
Yes, exactly. Back in the 60s, that was about Oh, we had. But then you became rather adventurous because you were determined to find, shall we say, purer food. Mm-hmm. So you went in search of hormone-free beef. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that experience.
Well, this was, I just felt there must be another way of, there must be other food out there. And it was also the time of the hippies, you know, there were these grocery stores like Fields of Plenty where you could get more farm-to-table food. So I thought I have to find better food. So I looked at the Yellow Pages, you know, this is before the Google time. And I had to look in the Yellow Pages and I looked under beef and I found a beef farm in the Eastern Shore where she said she sells you beef. And I called her up and she said, you know, my beef is wonderful and it has lots of marbling and it is, you know, it is fatty. And, you know, I give them only corn the last months. And I was so shocked and I said, how can you give them corn? I mean, where I grew up, you know, cattle ate grass, you know, they didn't eat corn. And she said, well, of course, I have to give them antibiotics that they can digest it. And I was so shocked. And then she said, of course, I give them also hormones so that they would eat more, so that they would fatten up faster. And I just thought, I can't believe this. And I think that's how I learned about agricultural practices in this country. And then I looked into vegetables, how they are grown, and I found out about all the pesticides. And I found out also that chickens got hormones and antibiotics. And I felt, you know, this can't be right. This can't be right. And looking around, I felt that that people really were much more thick than in Europe and looked much unhealthier and had so many more problems like cardiovascular problems and cholesterol and you know, going for quadruple bypasses and cancer. And I just felt there must be a connection of what we put in our bodies and how we feel. Mm. And that's really how it all started.
And then you found a butcher who, you said it almost felt like buying illegal drugs when you came face to face with him. Talk about that.
Well, then I looked in the Yellow Pages again, and I saw natural beef in Pennsylvania, and it was a certain Mr. Koenig. And he said to me, I said to him, I want to buy his beef. And he explained to me that he doesn't do, you know, all the things he didn't do. He doesn't give them hormones. He doesn't give them antibiotics. He doesn't fumigate the carcasses. And he told me many more things that he doesn't do. And I was just shocked. And I said, how can I get your beef? And he said, well, you know, I come into town once every 2 weeks, and I will call you up, you know, where we meet, and tell me what you want. And then the day before, I get a call and said, you know, come to the Chevy Chase Circle, you know, at 3:00. And so I did that, and there were already many cars there, mostly station wagons, and we all waited in our car. I mean, it was kind of very strange. And there came this truck around, and he stopped. He immediately jumped out of his truck. He opened the back of his truck, and he took out all these big styrofoam boxes and with names on it. And all the doors from this, station wagon opened, and the women scattered out and grabbed their boxes and ran. And I just felt that it was like a drug pickup or something. It was really weird.
And what all was in that box? I mean, how much beef was in that box?
Well, whatever you ordered. You know, I ordered mostly chuck steaks. I loved, my husband loved to grill. You know, that's something you don't do in Europe that often. And so I bought chuck steaks and I bought some roasts and of course, stew meat and hamburger meat for the kids. And I think everybody just told me, I asked a little around the women, I said, why are you here? And they all said, well, you know, I had cancer or I'm in treatment and I'm supposed to eat the cleanest food possible. And this is the best I could find.
So at this point in our food history, we do have grocery stores, supermarkets who do provide very much as you wished from farm to grocery store without hormones, without additives. That must make you very happy.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a long time. Think about it. My restaurant, I have been doing this for over 40 years. The restaurant is 36 years old, and I'm certified since 99. So that's a long time. But you know, it goes in the right direction, but it just moves at a snail's pace. But it's wonderful that now we have stores where we can actually really have an option and buy, you know, as you said, you know, more natural or more sustainable or more cleaner food, you know, and it's labeled. And that's another thing that's wonderful. It's really up to you to make the decision how you want to eat.
Nora Pouillon, her new book is titled My Organic Life, How a Pioneering Chef Helped Shape the Way We Eat Today. She is also the owner of Nora's Restaurant here in Washington, D.C. If you're here in town, you must stop there. Short break, right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, a national network of 5 cancer hospitals that combine conventional and integrative therapies to help patients maintain quality of life during treatment. Learn more at cancercenter.com. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, seeking to unlock the possibility inside every individual at gatesfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
And welcome back. Nora Pouillon is here. She's chef and owner of Restaurant Nora, the first certified organic restaurant in the country. She's written about her experiences first growing up as a child of war in the Austrian Alps, coming to this country, learning to cook herself, and ultimately establishing Restaurant Nora. Her new book is titled My Organic Life, How a Pioneering Chef Helped Shape the Way We Eat Today. So, Nora, you weren't born knowing how to cook. So you had to experiment, you had to learn. Tell us about cooking once you got here to the U.S.
Well, I came here, I was 21, just married to a Frenchman, and, you know, as you know, French people love to eat. So I had really to go to learn quickly how to eat. And I had help for friends that my husband knew from the Foreign Service. So it was, she took me to supermarkets and she took me around and I explored around and I found, luckily, lots of ethnic markets. You know, there was the French market and there was a Middle Eastern market and an Italian market. And I just read cookbooks. I read Elizabeth David. I read James Beard, How to Eat Better for Less Money was my Bible. I mean, I just, you know, it's in shreds now. And so I, because on top we didn't have much money. So I really got into it. I thought, you know, being a housewife, doing the laundry and vacuuming is not really the exciting part of being a housewife. For me, it was really cooking, because you had to create a menu, you had to find the products, you had to, to cook again. On top, you were sharing food, and everybody loved it.
Because of course.
It was just a win-win situation. So I really got into it, and then we entertained a lot, and some of my friends said, no, you know, please help me out. I have, you know, this person, you know, many of our friends were in a diplomatic service, and so I started helping them out, and then they said, you know, just show me how you do that. And so I started these informal cooking classes that then became more serious, because
your own home.
Yes, yeah. In my own home. But then we lived in Adams Morgan. We bought a house there that had a bigger kitchen. I mean, very rudimentary kitchen, but it was big enough to accommodate 9 people. And so I just started to give these classes. My whole development is sort of organic too, you know, from childhood with the farm, and then going to the French school where we were served three-course meals, and, you know, could eat in half an hour and then play, and then coming to this country and, you know, having to learn how to cook and learn about all the ingredients and learn about American agricultural practices, and deciding that, I didn't want to do that. And, you know, and also the motto of my father came to me a lot, which he said always, you know, health is the most important thing you have in your life, and no money in the world can buy it for you, and you better preserve it. And so all that came back to me, and so I incorporated in my cooking classes teaching people how to buy more wholesome food, and how to take a chicken and make like 5 meals out of it. And then one of my students said, hey, Nora, you know, I have a friend who just bought the Talbot Inn, and she's looking for somebody to open the restaurant in there.
I remember the Talbot Inn so well.
Oh, yeah.
I love the Talbot Inn. And you became the chef.
Yes, yes. It was 1976, and they had to install the kitchen, and I went there, and luckily they had a manager there, Stephen D'Amato, who then became my business partner with his brother. So I just had to learn. I mean, it was scary when she asked me to do it. I first said, oh, my God, I can't do that. This is really the next step. This is really the step into a professional life. And, you know, I had basically to start from zero. I just was thinking, okay, if I have 20 people and they drink, you know, a coffee with milk, how much milk do I have to buy? You know, I had to sit down and just go, you know, okay, 4 tablespoons per person, and that makes how many, this many cups, and this, and so I have to buy this many gallons of milk. And so that's how I really started out, just little by little.
Talk about those early recipes you created at the Tabard Inn. Give us an example.
Well, very simple. It was only open for lunch at the beginning for a long time, and so it was mostly salads and sandwiches. Well, I had this additive-free bacon, for instance, and I drove out to a farm in Virginia, the Potomac Vegetable Farm, and bought my tomatoes there and bought my arugula there. She had arugula. This is like 1977.
Brand new.
Yeah. And I just came back, and I was voted. I was very lucky because I got the support of the Washington Post. I knew Larry Stern, and I called him up the first day and said, Larry, I'm opening the Talbot Inn for lunch. Could you come? And he was wonderful. He came with like 20 people, and it was overwhelming. Actually, for me,
I'll
in the kitchen.
I'll bet. And what did you prepare that day?
I think I did the BLTs. I did a salade niçoise, which which nobody actually knew. People said, Nick, who is it? I did a roast pork sandwich, and I did a roast beef sandwich. I made my own mayonnaise. I had some good mustard. I got some good bread, you know, none of this Wonder Bread. I got, I think it was the Ottenburg bakery that existed.
Yes, I remember the Ottenburg bakery.
And so I had some, you know, rye bread and pumpernickel bread, and I toasted it so to make it, you know, a little firmer and give it more body. And people really loved it. My food was more in the Mediterranean style and perhaps continental. At that time, everything was French, you know, with heavy sauces and lots of butter sauces and cream sauces.
But, Nori, you also had children.
Mm-hmm.
How did you deal with your incredibly demanding role as a chef and your family life?
Well, I have to admit, probably not very well. The only thing is that all my kids now are, my kids are really wonderful, and they're very happy, and they're all chosen wonderful professions that sort of goes on in my spirit. And so even so, I was probably not the greatest mother. They turned out wonderful. And I think a lot is due because of their dad. So I really think fathers and partners are very important.
So important. So
help you out.
Important.
But at that time, the kids only came, came after school, and they did their homework at the restaurant after school and had an early dinner, or they had to... I saw them only on Sunday, you know. At that time, my husband and I, we were separated, and I lived across the street, so the kids could just run over see me, and it worked out well. It worked out well.
I'm
sure they told me once that they wish I would never had done the restaurant, because I was a stay-at-home mom for them for 8 years, and so it was a big adjustment for them. But as the years went on, and I did my own restaurant, and I got, you know, credit for it, and people liked it, they sort of felt proud of me.
Tell me about the transition to the creation of Nora's restaurant.
Well, that was a long... we left my partner and we left the Tabard Inn. His contract was finished, and so was mine. And we went and looked. It took us a year, actually, to find a space we could afford. And it was through pure chance, really through pure chance, because my son went to the... same school and class as the owner's son, and the son told my son that his father was sickly and that he was interested in selling the restaurant. So I went there, and I pretended I didn't know anything, and I just said to him, you know, I come to you for advice. What should I do? I'm really looking to open a restaurant. What do I have to do to find one? And he said, well, don't go any further.
Oh,
just stay here.
How wonderful. I remember John and I used to walk there on R Street. It's a lovely shaded street. You created an herb garden right out in front of the restaurant, and John and I would stop there to admire it, knowing what wonderful flavors were coming. What inspired you to put that herb garden out in front of the restaurant?
You know, Diane, it's really not a very... That's what happened is that the former owner had an outdoor cafe there, and the neighborhood refused it or didn't want it there. And we decided, okay, if they don't want it, what should we do? And that's when we decided, why don't we just pour lots of dirt on the garden and create a garden? And that's how it started out. And we started to plant some vegetable, but we realized that it's not big enough to be able to grow vegetables. So we decided on some fruit trees. We had a nectarine tree, and we have an apricot tree, and we have a fig tree, and herbs, and lots of herbs. And they're really... people love it, and some people pick it, and people say, why, do you mind? And I say, no, it's to share.
That's lovely. The starting of a restaurant must have seemed absolutely overwhelming.
It was, we started, I think what happened is that we had no money, and so we had to do very fast. So we signed the contract in December, and we opened the restaurant January 20th.
Oh, my God.
Like in a month. And we were in there. We signed the contract, and we were in there with sledgehammers, you know, tearing out things that we didn't like, and walls and some of the decor, which was pretty gaudy. And my partner Stephen's mother was sewing all the tablecloths, and we had collected, one of the investors had done these photographs about farmers markets, and we had them blown up and on the wall, and Ben Bradley and Sally Quinn, who lived around the corner, were investors too at the beginning, and it was just wonderful because they made the restaurant now their home, basically.
They believed in you.
Yeah, they were very nice. I mean, Sally said, just don't tell anybody that it's healthy. That's not a good thing to say.
But it is so healthy. And one thing we ought to point out are the beautiful quilts mm-hmm. that you put up all around. And people so admired them. Where did you find them? On your journeys around the area?
Yeah, I felt that my restaurant was really very American because I did the cuisines from all over the country. I had to because I had to buy whole animals and a whole beef gives you 900 pounds of ground meat. So if you go around the world, you find that every country has a great recipe for ground beef. And so I had to, I just felt America is a melting pot of all different cultures and cuisines. And so I said, what is really America for me? And America for me were, you know, folk art. I loved folk art. I loved the people that, you know, that make, you know, little sculptures out of wood, or this Amish quilt that I have. They are just absolutely wonderful.
Gorgeous. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want listeners to know that we've got some recipes up on our site. You can go to drshow.org. You can see instructions for how to make a Viennese flourless chocolate almond cake. And I've had this
yes.
at the restaurant. Tell us about it.
Well, it's a famous recipe in Vienna. It's first of all, it's my grandmother's recipe, and it's not completely flourless because it has breadcrumbs in it, but very few, and bread is made with flour. But I think my daughter, who is gluten-free, she can eat it, so there's not much in it. But the recipe, basically, it's only butter, eggs, sugar, almonds and chocolate. And how can that be bad?
It was divine. I had it the other day. You've also got roasted red and yellow beets with citrus, feta cheese and pomegranate vinaigrette, and some other wonderful recipes at our website, drshow.org/blog. So if you're in the mood, go to that website. You know, Nora, we've got lots of calls, but I'm going to hold off until after our break as to when to take those calls. I wonder about your first opening night at the restaurant.
Well, it was overwhelming. I think we were very excited. It was, and because, again, we had this wonderful, friends around the neighborhood. We did like 50 people. And I remember we were in the kitchen. We were so few people in the kitchen because we couldn't afford it. And my partner and I, we were cooking, and we had one other person and a dishwasher. And Thomas, my other partner, was out there. He was the host, the barman, and the manager.
I know Thomas well.
And we did, I think we did 35 or 40 people, and we thought, oh, however can we do more than that? Because we were completely exhausted. Of course, we had no experience, and we didn't know that, you know, all these people came all on the same time. That's why it was so exhausting. But what was also very nice at the beginning is that we had to live off the tips that Thomas got.
Interesting. Fascinating. All right, short break here. When we come back, time to open the phones. Your questions, comments for Nora Pouillon. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the financial services firm of Raymond James, for over 50 years offering wealth management, banking, and capital markets expertise, with a focus on putting the client's financial well-being first. Learn more at raymondjames.com. And from Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, offering experiences for grandparents and grandchildren, active outdoor enthusiasts, and others. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org.
On the next Fresh Air, true tales from the life of a New York City cop. We meet retired Lieutenant Steve Osborne. In his 20 years on the job, he made thousands of arrests, but he never fired his gun.
At the last possible second, I found another way to resolve it. But make no mistake about it, if I had to do it, I would do it.
He has a new memoir. Join us.
Welcome back. Nora Pouillon is here. She's the chef and owner of Restaurant Nora here in Washington, D.C. It is the first certified organic restaurant in the country. She's finally written a memoir. It's titled My Organic Life, How a Pioneering Chef Helped Shape the Way We Eat Today. Let's open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Al in Cleveland, Ohio. You're on the air. Hi, Al.
Hi, Diane. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks, sir.
Thanks for having this topic. So I just have a comment and a question. I live in a section of Cleveland called Ohio City. The councilperson has done a great job for urban farming legislation. He's one of the top people in the country. And my wife has taken that and turned our double lot into one whole lot into garden space, complete with farm animals that we use to try to be more sustainable. I'm also, and we are not certified organic, we're organic. But my challenge with certified organic is its availability to the masses and its cost. And how do you see that cost coming down so it's more available and prevalent to the masses?
Well, you know, there are two things. One of them is also a question of demand. You know, the more demand is, the lower the price will get. And organic food, I always say, you know, it's more expensive, but that's the real price of food. You know, in Europe, food is much more expensive than here. In this country, cheap food has been pushed so much forward that people think that's actually the price of food, but it's not true. Most food here is subsidized. And, you know, you don't see a farmer driving around in a Cadillac. It's not, they're not getting richer. That's what it is. And I think it's more the quality and not the quantity that is the focus of organic food. And the other thing is that I feel that if you eat, you know, wholesome food, food without all the chemical additives, you actually do something for your health. And as I say, I prefer to spend my money on food than on a doctor. And I think that's what it comes down to, because if you feed your body, think about all the additives, the chemicals, the pesticides you put in your body. I mean, I read somewhere, you know, I shouldn't probably say it because I don't know the source of it, that every person in this country ingests 4 pounds of pesticides a year by eating conventional food. I mean, it can't be good for you. I mean, don't you want to put the best possible food into your body to feel really well and to stay healthy? I think for me that's really the priority, and I prefer to eat beans and rice and not raspberries and, you know some expensive things. And if you eat seasonal, that's another thing, it's much cheaper. If you eat seasonal, if you eat what is actually grown in that time, you know, like in the winter you eat all these root vegetables and all the chards and the kales, and in the summer you can have your fruit and your fruit.
But, you know, the problem is that with many grocery stores, we have come to expect any vegetable, any fruit, any time. Mm. They're not just grown here in the area or in Ohio. They're grown all over the country, shipped in, and that's how you get into not eating what's right at that time.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I remember when my cookbook came out, it was a seasonal menu cookbook. One of the interviewers actually on television asked me, how do you know what season it is? And I was just completely, you know, taken back. I mean, I didn't know how to respond to that. But then I quickly thought, and I thought, you know, this person is absolutely right, because if you go to the store, you have no idea what season it is.
Exactly.
And you see, the nice thing about farmers markets is that they change that. And when people come to the farmers market, I often hear them, oh, they have nothing here. They have nothing here. And because that's what it is, you know, there is a time in the winter when you eat only certain things. You eat winter squashes and root vegetables and kale and chard. And we are so lucky that kale salad has become the big thing, because now kale has become fashionable. But that's what you have to eat, and I think that's what your body needs.
Someone the other evening at a dinner I attended served a kale chef salad. Mm-hmm. It was delicious. Mm-hmm. Really, really good. Let's go to Steve in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Diane.
Sure.
I just want to say, first off, the whole food farm-to-table movement was great for my city. We have some great restaurants as a result of that, so thank you very much.
Good.
My question for you is, I recently saw a report that kind of looked at organic vegetables and said, if you take an organic vegetable, like a tomato, and you breed it to be insect-resistant, as a result of doing that, you take that vegetable, that tomato, and you compare it to one that's been sprayed with pesticides, the organic actually has more carcinogens, more cancer-causing agents, because there's a higher concentration of carcinogens in the organic tomato because it's been bred that way. I want to know what your thoughts are on that whole idea, or if you've ever heard of that.
Well, I haven't heard of that. The only thing I've heard is that the GMO tomatoes, you know, so they're genetically modified, where they put a gene of something completely different, like a fish, into a tomato, so that the tomato can withstand the cold weather. And I think, you know, I'm absolutely against that because, you know, I don't feel I should be a guinea pig, you know. I think they should, if they want to do genetically modified food, they should try it out first for 10, 20 years, for a generation, to see what the impact is on not only on the people but also on the environment, because it's that's one of the big things, that the seeds basically inundate all different farms. And I think also, you know, it's all the pharmaceutical companies that basically push that, and with the logo that it helps us to feed the world. You know, it's not quantity we need. We need quality. We need quality. And so I think that, for me, a tomato should be eaten in the summer or in the fall when it's, you know, it had, the tomato has 6 hours of sun, so that it has a lot of a flavor. It tastes delicious. And it has also, it's at the peak of its nutritional value. So I think to have a tomato to go all year round so that you can have all year round a tomato, that's the wrong spirit.
So that must mean that you have a certain amount of farmers in this area on whom you know you can rely.
Well, that is true. There are not that many, unfortunately, organic, certified organic farmers in the area, because the climate is very difficult here. You know, it's very humid, so fungus is the big thing here. And so, for instance, to have an orchard, an organic orchard, is nearly impossible here because of the fungus. And you know, also winery. I went once to see a winery in I think it was in Maryland, I think the Naked Mountain or something winery, and perhaps I shouldn't even say the name because it was so long ago. And I said, I was there and I asked the man, well, first of all, when I drove in the winery, there was a big, on the barn was a big sign, you know, the bones crossed, you know, with the dead skull on it, meaning don't go into that barn. And then I asked the winemaker, you know, do you have to spray? And he said, and what do you spray? And he said, you name it, I do it. I have to spray up to 14 times.
Whoa.
And I said, okay, I mean, I understood. It's very, the climate is just, Thomas Jefferson couldn't grow grapes because, you know, then there were no fungicides around or no pesticides.
So where do the wines come from that you serve at your restaurant?
Well, many come from the West Coast, of course, from Washington State, Oregon, California, because most of the wine we serve at the restaurant, it's marked. The grapes are grown organically. You know, it's very important for me that the grapes are grown organically. In the winemaking process here in America, we use sulfites, which in Europe are allowed to say that you're certified organic even if you use sulfites, because the sulfites are in nature. And in America, you cannot say that you have certified organic wine. You know, so what we say, that the grapes are grown organically.
I see. All right, let's go to Michelle in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I enjoy listening to your show,
and I've
bought many books based on your author interviews, and we'll probably get this one too.
Good.
My question is kind of, Nora, you talked about that your restaurant is certified organic. And is that the USDA organic, or is that, yes?
Yes, it's USDA certified organic.
Okay. Because I think, I think there might be some other organizations in the U.S. that have, like I've heard, certified TERF or something like that, something in Oregon. But anyway, my question is kind of, there's that, and you get a lot of certified organic, but it tends to be more expensive. And so we have a family with a total of six people. I can't always afford that, but we buy at our local farmer's market. And a lot of them practice the certified organic, but they're not certified because they don't want to pay. How do you feel about that, kind of?
I think that's wonderful. I think if you have the chance to go to the farmer's market and you can talk with the farmer and find out, you know, about his farming practices and when he sprays and what does he spray? I mean, I hope not Roundup. So I think that's great. That's great. But you know, I have a restaurant and I have to go after certain rules because I get my products from all over the country, and so I cannot travel to all these farmers
exactly
and find out what kind of practice they have. So I have to go with the rule, and the rule is that I have that 95% whatever comes into restaurant comes from certified organic farmers or producers or, you know, wholesalers, and I'm inspected once a year to check really if my invoices and my certifications and what I see on the menu correspond to each other. And I feel that if you have a chance to be at your farmer's market and buy it, you know, that is wonderful because you support the local economy, you support the land around you by supporting these farmers, and you support your own health and the health of your family. So I think it's only a win-win thing. And as I said before, just don't buy grains and legumes. That helps.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Mary Ann in Wimberley, Texas, you're on the air.
Well, this is wonderful. I have never called in before, and I listen to you regularly. I live in a little pocket of land outside of Austin that gets your station and program, and about a half a mile square.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, I'm hoping that Austin will take you in. So I just wanted to give a little history. I was involved back in the 60s with the start of Green's Restaurant. I don't know if you all know
Green. Yeah, I know Green's Restaurant very well in San Francisco.
Yes. And Green's has been, an organic, I don't know if they're certified, but it's organic, vegetarian. Nowadays, they might serve some meat, I'm not sure. But, the whole organic gardening, farming, restaurant business, I think really started in the San Francisco area. And it's so interesting to see, I'm really enjoying this program, to see the history of, you know, what's happened in the last 50 years, because where I live, there's a number of organic gardeners, but they have no idea of their history.
Well, I think if you read my book, you will even find that there's organic. I talk about how organic came about and the history of organic. You know, it was started very early on, and then Rodale took it over.
Yes, I remember that.
Yes, then the Farm Bill came about, and then it sort of moved on into more the organic movement.
What about Alice Waters and Shay Panisse?
Oh, she's wonderful.
She is.
She's wonderful. Of course, she lives in California, where it's very easy to have all the produce, fresh produce you want to have all year round. But what she did really, and her energy was put on that, two things. One of them that she introduced American products to the American people before the restaurants imported most of their food, like Italian restaurant imported all their food from Italy, French restaurant from France. And so she said, you know, we can do American food. So that's how the term California cuisine came about. And also what she does now for the school lunches and the movement she started with her school garden is just really wonderful. I think she's not certified organic. She wanted to be it, but I think she has too many friends who grow for her who could not become certified organic because, I don't know, they're not big enough. I don't know the reasons, but I mean, she does so many other things that point in the right direction. You know, who cares?
Absolutely. And as an added benefit to the recipes at our website, I want to let you know that Nora Pouillon is staying after the show to chat directly with you in a Facebook Q&A. You can post questions at facebook.com/The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to get started right at noon. Nora Pouillon, her new book is titled My Organic Life. Nora, it's so good to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Lovely. And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yerblifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts.